Stu Does America.
Follow the show on YouTube, youtube.com/Stu Does America. Be sure to subscribe, hit the bell for notifications. Rob Eno is here to check in on how our friends in the mainstream media are doing. I'm sure perfectly fine. Jasmine Crockett is doubling down on the dumb, if you can believe it. I can. We'll look at the latest there. But we're going to start by doing the home buyer's dilemma. Ah, yes, there's been a panic going on right now. And I want to address this. I talked about it a little bit yesterday, but I want to go a little bit more in depth on a particular chart. And yes, this is the show that tells you we're going to do a monologue about a chart in advance. That's us. Okay, so welcome to it. I'm sure you're happy that you're here. Home buyers are older than ever. First-time home buyers are getting older. Kind of a shocking number is the quote. There are clear reasons behind the trend. Younger Americans are struggling to save for a down payment as they stretch their paychecks to cover student loans, a rising cost of living, and most critically, high rents, which makes saving money harder. And even if they have saved diligently, a persistent lack of affordable housing inventory has left them shut out of the market. This has been kind of the basic analysis of this, and it's been pretty much everywhere. I mean, I've seen, you know, senators, congressmen that I love, conservatives out there saying, you know, this is a massive crisis. I've seen the same from liberals. I mean, their solutions are different, but they're all saying it's a massive crisis. We're even seeing this in the media, like this clip discussion from CNBC.
The other data point, guys, that I wanted to bring up, this is really crazy. So we got some data from the National Association of Realtors on housing. We've been talking about here on this show for a while. Diana Olick has been talking about how difficult it is out there to buy a home, the affordability challenges, the mortgage rates. Did you guys see this? The median age of first-time home buyer, 40 years old. And that's like a shocking number. That's a record high.
All right, so you get the point. That's kind of been the worry of everybody. And it's understandable, right? Like 40 is considerably high. Again, these numbers are from this particular article. The typical first-time homebuyer, now 40 years old, a record high, as they mentioned. It's from realtor.com. And can we pause on that for just a second here? This data that's freaking everybody out, that everybody is panicking about, that everyone wants to change all of our policies to address the crisis that is ongoing in home ownership, is from realtor.com. I mean, every time I bring up a study, someone will bring up, hey, that's paid for by big condiments. That's the ketchup industry is funding that study. You can't trust it. But we're going to take our data directly from realtor.com, who is not exactly without a dog in this fight. I'm just going to say them wanting new policies to encourage homeownership is, it's not exactly out of the realm of a possibility that that's what they're rooting for. But I trust the data. I think it's real. And I think there is a legitimate increase. In fact, you see it quite clearly in the data. Here is the chart that has gone viral over and over again. You see a massive increase from the beginning of the chart, which is in the 1980s, when the first time homeowner was 29 years old. It has now risen all the way to 40 years old. That is a big, big, big increase, and it is significant. Now, one of the things I want to point out to you, and this is something that, let me start here, because I think this is an important part of this particular story and this particular chart before we get to the bigger picture. What we're seeing here is not a slow rise from 1980 until today. What we're seeing is almost no change in this data whatsoever for multiple decades, and then a straight up line very recently. Because I'm a loser, I drew an extra green line on this chart so you can see what I'm talking about. What you see is a straight line, 32 years old in like 1993, 32 years old in 2019. Almost zero increase in that time period. We're talking about, you know, multiple decades. This is the time from when I was in like high school until COVID, okay? And then what do you see after, as soon as COVID hits? A straight line up. Now, while that is still a big concern and a big issue. And if you happen to be in the ages where you're like, let's say you were, I don't know, like 35 years old and you're going through your age now, 35 to 40 after COVID, you're like, wait a minute, I can't get a house. And it does feel constricting to you. This is a 5-year period where we have seen a massive change in this number. I'm not downplaying that. I am curious to know if what the real answer to this rise is, however, is just a one-time artifact from the COVID pandemic. Remember, this was a massively life-changing part of our time on this earth, right? This is going to change financial futures from now till the end of, you know, our lives. And it is, you know, of course, has hit us when it comes to employment and savings and your, if you have a small business and all these things. A lot of those hit us really hard in 2020 and kind of went away. Not everything has. Inflation, of course, we remember hanging around for a while, pretty in really significant ways in the Biden administration. It's come down a little bit overall, but we're all dealing with those built up years of the Biden inflation. And now the inflation is building on top of those already high numbers. That's costing us a fortune, and that's a real problem. It also makes things less and less affordable. And of course, affordability has been a big topic of late when it comes to elections. But think about this as an issue of not necessarily an economic issue that goes back 50 years, but one that goes back 5 years. And if you think about the way this progressed, it kind of makes sense, I think, if you consider it. Remember, we go into 2019 with the economy chugging along really, really well. Everything's going great. Then we have the pandemic. Well, what's our reaction to the pandemic? First of all, we start sending checks to everybody. Then we send more checks to everybody. Then we send a third batch of checks to everybody. We subsidize healthcare. We just dump money into the economy in a way that literally has never happened in the history of the world. This was not a minorly significant. Oh, gosh. Yeah, that was a crazy time. I remember that recession in 1992. That's not what this was. This was one of the most catastrophic and crazy changes to an economy in the history of the world. And when it comes to just money being dumped into economy, there's never been anything like this before. And I don't know, World War II, kind of a reason for that one. This was just flooding the economy with money. So people's savings went up really, really fast. In fact, they went up so fast that when you look at the data of people in like Gen Z, they actually have more savings now than their parents and grandparents did at this time in their life. People don't even believe that number to be true. It's not all certainly COVID related, but it's actually not nearly as bad as the, you know, as Gen Z necessarily makes this problem out to be. But this affordability problem for homes is real. And if you follow the line of events, we have COVID. Everyone loses their job. We send them tons and tons of money all over the place. That causes massive, massive inflation. In turn, raises rates on mortgages. And now we go from, in a very short period of time, from 3% mortgages for everybody to 6, 7, 8, 9% mortgages for everybody. And you follow that line of thought. What does that do to you if you're a consumer looking for a house? On both sides. If you happen to be a young person trying to make your way up through the world, it gets very, very difficult, right? Because these prices are, they all, you know, your monthly payment looks like too expensive for what you're getting, right? You are paying a lot on your mortgage. And then you connect that to the other side of the equation. And I'll tell you right now, I'm on the other side of the equation, okay? I am a person who bought a house, and actually in the potentially the greatest timing of all and all of my financial past, refinanced my mortgage in, I think it was like late 2019. And I was like, I need to get out of this rate. So I lowered my mortgage, put it in a 30-year fixed at 3%. I am never leaving this home. A 3% mortgage, I should stay there till I die. I said this yesterday, but if every street, every house on my street turned into a crack house, I would be like, you know, I don't, it's still 3% though. I mean, can we make friends with the crack dealers? What can we do to make this work? Because I would never want to leave here. And of course, this is going to shrink supply. People who are in houses aren't leaving the houses. They're not leaving the houses to even go up and increase and buy new houses because they're thinking to themselves, well, I got to pay that new mortgage. I don't want to do that. I want to stay put. People are staying put a lot more. And then simultaneously, people are looking at the next house and saying, gosh, I'd be paying basically, if I'm going to downsize, right? Like if you're like, you know, maybe getting to the empty nest stage and you're like, I'm going to downsize. Well, you downsize, you up your mortgage cost, you want to pay the same cost for a worse house. Who wants to do that? On the other side of this, you have a situation where younger people are looking at this and saying, wait a minute, I know what a $300,000 house looks like. I know what a $400,000 house looks like. but these payments are way higher than I expected. I can't afford the $400,000 house. I can only afford the $250,000 house or the $300,000 house. It's a massive difference. And it, you know, chips away at this. And there's a lot of economic parts of this. New York Times hits some of them here. People who already own homes accruing huge amounts of equity thanks to soaring values and low pre-pandemic mortgage rates. That allows them to make larger down payments and all cash offers when they want to buy something new. First-time buyers, especially younger ones, can't compete. The question is, will they be able to? And I think that is the big question, right? If this is a 5 to 10 year period where we're dealing with the fallout of terrible economic policy brought to you by largely Democrats, then it's something we might be able to survive, even though it really will be a pain for younger people who are trying to grow their homes, grow their families, grow their financial future. And it is something, you know, this has basically been talked about as an election issue. And all the stuff I'm saying today really has nothing to do with the next election, okay? All this stuff is not going to win you an election. Just say, well, you know, this is a short-term thing. It'll go away is not an election-winning message. I get that. And these politicians are going to come out and they're going to make all sorts of proposals. The question is, as we tried to do on this program, is not to look at things directly through that lens only, to look at it as the bigger picture. What is the right thing to do for people as they grow through their lives? So with interest rates really high right now, you could move to downsize and pay the same mortgage if you wanted to. But the bigger question here is, if you're a younger person, how do you get into a home? And these homes just seem too expensive to you, right? Like, you, even if you have enough money to pay for them, you feel like you're not getting enough value. So maybe I'm just going to stay renting for now. So the question is the American dream dead, right? Is the home ownership dream for the younger American gone forever? Let me just take it to a bigger question, though. That goal is in question right now. It really is. But is it the right goal? Is home ownership the right goal for every younger person? I will say this, as a homeowner, a lot of it sucks, okay? A lot of the home ownership experience blows. It is not fun. There's a lot about renting that is actually great comparison to home ownership. If you think about your life, it's like, oh, well, everybody's like, oh, you got to get into this home ownership. There's a home ownership. Lack of home ownership is a crisis. Yeah, let's get everybody started. You know what's great? Replacing your roof. That's fantastic. You know what else I love? Oh, gosh, it's fantastic when a pipe explodes and you have to replace your entire downstairs and deal with all those repairs on your own. That's a lot of fun. You know what else is fun? Paying property taxes to schools that my kids don't go to, or maybe you don't have kids at all. Paying those taxes is loads and loads of fun. And if you really want to stick it to the man, if you really want to get him, then you too can pay multiple decades of almost nonstop interest payments to banks. That is what makes you really feel like you're sticking it to the man. Let me tell you, get in on this when you can, Gen Z. Cross that line. Look, I'm, you know, someone wrote, I kind of mockingly posted something like that on Twitter, and someone said, hey, you know, I love you, love the show, but like, don't gaslight people into thinking that renting is better than home ownership. And I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that renting is always better than home ownership. What I'm saying is the difference is a lot closer than we talk about, because all of those things I talked about are extra expenses that you're stuck with when you're a homeowner. People don't think about that, because what they do is they say, well, I bought a house for $250,000 and I sold it for $300,000. That was a $100,000 profit. No, it was not. I assure you, it was not. Most of the money, whenever you're spending mortgage payments through those years, most of that money was not going to equity. It was going to the banks in the form of interest payments. That's just renting, right? Like, all, you know, 90% of the money that you're spending in those first few years is just rent money. Anyway, you might build a little bit of equity. You might have your home value go up, but of course, that could go both ways, right? That is a situation that you're, you know, kind of betting on the market there. So it can be really beneficial, and it can be great for certain circumstances, but it's just not necessarily the universal solution for every 30-year-old. I mean, there are real restrictions that come along with home ownership for a 30-year-old. You know, if you think about owning a home at 30, you're building a career, right? You're building a life. And what owning a home does, and this could be really good for you if you're going to be there for a long time, but it locks you into a community. It locks you into a spot. You it's going to be a little bit harder to move. You're going to have to deal with tons and thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars of fees to get in and out of where you're living. If you get a job offer from three states away, you know what kind of process that is if you've ever moved around before. Again, there's nothing wrong with this as an approach, but it might be a better approach for people who have established themselves and have moved to a place that they know they want to stay for a long time. You know, I moved around a million times in my life. Sometimes it's been renting, sometimes it's been buying. Sometimes those purchases have worked out, sometimes they dramatically have not, including the house that I bought in 2007. Didn't do so well on that one. Because I was at the whims of the market. You know, there's a lot of fees, a lot of hassles associated with that. And if you're building a career, it might be better to have your options open, frankly, at 30 years old than trying to build the tiniest amount of equity in multiple years of mortgage payments. Home ownership locks you into an area, not as well as financially. And you can be, like I was, a victim of a housing market that turns the wrong way at the wrong time. If you buy a house and then you have a downturn in the market that lasts 5 years, you're kind of stuck at that house for 5 years. You know, unlike when you're renting, when you can move around when you need to, that is not really an option when it comes to buying. Again, this is not a I'm not bashing homeownership, as the commenter was saying. What I'm saying is it is much more a decision than we act like it is. We act like everyone wants to be a homeowner and that's the right thing for everybody, and some people can achieve it and some can't, when the real equation should probably be, hey, is it right for you to be a homeowner? Is it the right thing? Is it the right approach for you at this time? You know, if you're building a family and you get there and you're like, my kids are going to be in this same school for the next 15 years, homeownership is probably a really good approach for you. But that's not really the way it normally goes. A lot of people say they want equity, and this is how people are going to build equity. You can't just throw your money away in rent. And I totally understand that idea. We just talked about, though, how at least for the first 5 years to 10 years of your mortgage, you're basically renting anyway. It's important to understand that if the market goes crazy, goes up, yeah, you can build equity, but that's just you investing in a market that you can't control. That's what that is. You're sending lots of money in a mortgage payment to the bank over that period, and that's basically just the same as renting. Normally, what normally happens is for roughly equivalent properties, you're going to be able to rent something at a cheaper rate than you are to buy. And if you do that, and if you are disciplined, and if you take the extra money that you have up above your rent that would have necessarily gone to a mortgage and instead save that money, you oftentimes, they've run the numbers on this a bunch of times, oftentimes will wind up ahead of the game, not behind it, ahead of the game. Why? Because putting money into a home is actually a really inefficient way of building it, because you're putting money and you're locking it up, and it's not earning interest. It's not doing anything. It's just sitting there. The value of your home going up and down can make you a lot of money, but building equity by payments is really an inefficient way of doing it. It's essentially just renting anyway. If you were able to take the extra money, put that aside, you are able to build money even faster over a longer period of time, not to mention it's in your control, not sitting in your equity. Now, a lot of people will say, well, people are pretty irresponsible and won't actually do that, right? They're going to spend above and beyond their mortgage payment or their rent payment, no matter what it is. So you might as well be mortgaged, because what it is in its best way is a forced savings program. You have no choice but to put the money in. You put it in, therefore you don't spend it at the bar or on, avocado toast. And that's, true. It is true that it can help a lot of people, particularly young people that might not be great at financial planning. But also, having financial discipline can go a long way. Maybe some financial literacy would go a long way to making this situation better for younger people. Let's see. What else do I have to hit here? The one thing that is the... The one easy trick to solve all your financial problems, the one thing that does really make homeownership advantageous is something that is real, but it is kind of silly that this is the only thing that really makes it advantageous to own a home. The answer to this is you get to deduct your interest, right? The government laws that have made it tax-advantaged approach to being able to lower your mortgage payments in essentially by being able to deduct your taxes, your interest on your taxes, is a big advantage of homeownership. That makes a big difference, and it makes it close. if it wasn't for that, it wouldn't even be close. Because when you think about all the money that you're sticking in repairs and all the money that you're doing by maintaining the property and all the money that you're doing when you're fixing stuff and you're all the crap that goes into home ownership, not to mention property taxes, when you add all that stuff up, it just destroys the advantage over renting when you're talking about, you know, building equity. The mortgage interest rate deduction goes a long way. Now, economists, generally speaking, hate that deduction. They think it makes all sorts of bad choices look better than they are. However, that is a big advantage, and it is the real world. That thing exists, and you could take advantage of it, and it does help you. So it makes it a lot closer for a lot of people. And if you go into your home, and you stay in your home for 30 years, and you pay off that mortgage, you're going to do great with a home, almost definitely. I mean, like, over a long period of time like that, you'll have the market swing up, you'll have everything paid off, you'll still be paying property tax, but, like, you will basically own your home. In a 30-year period, it's going to be great. In fact, a 20-year period, it's probably really great to own a home. But that is not necessarily how people react. For a very long time, the average time that people bought and sold a home for was 6 years. They move in 2025, they move out in 2031. That's how it was for a long time. Part of the story that goes back to the chart. Remember the fancy chart we talked about at the beginning, where it's very flat for a long period of time of the average homeowner, and then all of a sudden it juts up at the end of COVID. A big part of that story is that people are not leaving their homes. No longer are they doing the six-year, buy, sell, upgrade, buy, sell, upgrade thing. They're not doing that like they used to. And this has happened at a pretty fast pace. The typical home seller in 2025 has now owned their home for 11 years, an all-time high. 10-year is up from 10 years last year. And from 2000 to 2008, it was just 6 years. So it has basically doubled in the last two decades. And most of that has happened pretty darn recently. That is a big factor in this as well. People are just staying in their homes. And the funny thing about all of this is the best way that you can do this home ownership thing is buying a home and staying in it for a long period of time. Now, people are doing that, and we're calling it a crisis. This is the right approach if you're buying a home. You should try to buy the right home for you that you could stay in for a long period of time and stay in it for a long period of time and reap the benefits of long-term property ownership, which do exist. Trading in and out, you're basically just hoping for the best when it comes to the market. And I had a situation where I bought and sold a house, and I made we bought it at the right time. It was like, it was 2000, maybe 5, 6 in that range. And we caught the market at the right time. We bought our house and sold it like 2 or 3 years later. It made like 30% on the home. It was this big, maybe it was even 30, maybe 40% on the home. It was a big, big gain. And then I went through a spreadsheet, and this is what black-pilled me on all this. I went through the spreadsheet and added up all the money that I wound up spending and all the interest that I wound up spending and all the, different costs of owning the home and the property taxes and all these other things. And at the end of it, I made nothing. Nothing. I had no profit on the home. Nothing. Because, at the end of the day, now I basically rented it for free for a couple of years, which is a heck of an advantage. It's certainly better than just renting. You can't look at it as the buy number and the sell number, and then that's how much you profit. That's not real. And when we tie this into the bigger picture here, when it comes to the American dream, the American dream is bigger than whether you own a home or not. If the American dream is just the difference between you renting and you owning a home, then the country kind of sucks, doesn't it? Like, that's it. Like, I had great times when I was renting. I had great times when I owned a home. Like, that wasn't the difference between me having the American dream or not. It can be an important ingredient to building a financial future that allows you to do the things that you want to do. And of course, that's part of the American dream, right? You're living in a community, you're growing a family, you're building something together with your spouse and your neighborhood, and it grows into this great thing, and you have a relationship inside your community. That's all real. That's the American dream, though. And that can happen whether you rent or you own. Ownership sometimes makes that easy if it's appropriate and long-term. But it's not necessarily the answer for everybody. And I think if we go into this mode, and this is why I'm freaked out about this, if we go into this mode, we're going crazy, and we're calling this a crisis, and we're saying this is the worst thing that's ever happened to society, what almost always happens out of that formula is terrible government policy. Look at COVID's the same thing. It's the worst pandemic ever. Everything's going to be terrible. What happened? It caused this. We constantly make massive mistakes when we get into this panic crisis type of mindset. And I'm really hoping that we can look at this and say, okay, there really are problems here. Maybe we could address some of those. Maybe we can encourage home ownership to these types of people at this times or these times. But at the end of the day, let's take a breath, right? Like, look at this in a sober fashion and make sure we're calm, cool, and collected before we pass the next $10 trillion disaster. When you walk through clothing stores today, everything kind of feels the same, right? It's like light and flimsy. And, you know, it might be designed to catch your eye, which is great. Maybe it's going to last you for a couple of weeks, a couple of months, a couple of wears, but probably going to fall apart by the time the next fall or winter comes around, right? It's, you know, the industry kind of decided that good enough was the new standard, and we all kind of went along with it. But some companies never bought into that idea, and American Giant is one of them. They build clothes the old-fashioned way, not nostalgic, but, you know, like intentional, right? Heavy fabrics, strong, you know, seams, real craftsmanship, like the real stuff, right? Every piece is cut and sewn right here in the U.S. in workshops where, you know, people still take pride in making something that's supposed to hold up for years, not weeks. And when you put it on, you can feel the difference immediately. Hoodies and tees don't feel, you know, mass produced. They feel personal. They feel like something that you already kind of has a story. It's something that you've been wearing for years and years and years and years, and it lasts forever. It's the kind of clothes that break in, not break down. They can slowly become yours the way, you know, like a great leather wallet or a perfectly worn in pair of boots does. You're going to love it. Buy American today at American-Giant.com/stew. Save 20% when you use the code STEW at checkout. The website is American-Giant.com/stew. Use the promo code STEW at checkout. It's American-Giant.com/stew for American Giant. I'm joined once again by Rob Eno, managing editor of Blaze News. Rob, how's it going?
Hey, pretty good.
Good, good. First of all, congratulations on your New England Patriots.
Oh, it's fantastic.
They had a rough year. They've had a couple of rough years.
It's been five long years in the wilderness.
I mean, you can't complain as a Patriot. There's no one feels bad for you. You had the most glorious run. You had Tom Brady for a zillion years. You had six Super Bowls?
Six. Well, we went to nine and won six.
Won six, yeah. Now, you did, I just want to point out, one of the losses was to the Philadelphia Eagles.
For whatever reason, we did not do well with the NFC East.
Yeah, I know. I did the Giants and the Eagles. That was it. But they look great. Were they 9-2? 8-2?
9-2.
9-2. Drake May looking awesome.
Have the weakest strength of schedule for the rest of the season.
Okay.
Which is fantastic.
Yes.
You know, we've got the Bengals without Ja'Marr Chase, who learned apparently that you should not spit on opposing players.
We've had some players who don't know that yet.
Yeah, you lose $500,000 because he's suspended for a game. And
it'd be pricey.
It might make people think that there is a script because he's not playing against the Patriots, but maybe there is, maybe there isn't. But if there is, I'm all down for it.
Whatever's happening, I just love it. Now, of course, the Eagles have been very good lately, and they've been on a great run, and it's easy to enjoy. But I really do love the NFL. I'm not one of these people that are like, I don't like what two players did when they took a knee. Therefore, I'm going to abandon the sport I love. It's fine if you did it. I don't criticize you for it, but it's just not in my DNA.
Yeah, no, it's been fun. I go to a Patriots meetup group here in Dallas, and it's amazing to see how many people more are coming each week.
Oh yeah.
Like the last few years, there's been like five of us, four of us going to the games, and now it's more and more and more and more. So it's great.
Well, while we're on the topic of things that we very much enjoy, I must bring to you Jasmine Crockett, who is among my favorite people on the planet. I can't love her more than I do. She makes me laugh every day. She brings joy to my life. She is the exact Democrat, like if I could have created one in a lab to make me specifically happy, I would have created her. Yeah. She's been, you know, out there as she always is, running her mouth constantly with nonsense. Let me give you this moment from CNN, which encapsulates the entire storyline here. First of all, you'll see the clip of her a couple of days ago calling out Jeffrey Epstein for donating to Republicans. We talked about this a little bit yesterday. I think it was that, you know, this wasn't the same Jeffrey Epstein. And then we get her ridiculous response to it. There's so much good stuff in here. Let's play the clip and react to it.
You mentioned Lee Zeldin there. He's now a cabinet secretary. He responded and said it was actually Dr. Jeffrey Epstein, who's a doctor that doesn't have any relation to the convicted sex trafficker. Unfortunate for that doctor, but that is who donated to a prior campaign of his. Do you want to correct the record on the people that—
I never said that it was that Jeffrey Epstein. Just so that people understand, when you make a donation, your picture is not there. And because they decided to spring this on us in real time, I wanted the Republicans to think about what could potentially happen, because I knew that they didn't even try to go through the FEC. So my team, what they did is they Googled. And that is specifically why I said a Jeffrey Epstein. Unlike Republicans, I at least don't go out and just tell lies. Because it was not the same one, that's fine. But when Lee Zeldin had something to say, all he had to say was it was a different Jeffrey Epstein. He admitted that he did receive donations from a Jeffrey Epstein, so at least I wasn't trying to mislead people. Now, have I dug in to find out who this doctor is? I have not. So I will trust and take what he says, is that it wasn't that Jeffrey Epstein, but I was not attempting to mislead anybody. I literally had maybe 20 minutes before I had to do that debate.
Yeah, but people might see that and say, well, you're trying to make it sound like he took money from
a
registered sex offender.
No, but I literally did not know.
Yeah, we know. We get it. You didn't know. That's the whole problem. I'm just writing down like 15 pages of notes here. Rob, just give me a reaction to it.
I literally only have like 20 minutes to see if it was Jeffrey Epstein who listed himself as a doctor on the filing. And I heard somebody on the internet say, I have a feeling that like Jeffrey Epstein might be like 1% of all the doctors in the United States with the name like Jeffrey Epstein, right? It's like, it's insane.
Some of the donations happened after Jeffrey Epstein was dead. So it would be very difficult for him to donate at that time.
Well, maybe she doesn't believe he's dead.
Oh, maybe that's it. Could be. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised with her.
I did like that she started out with prep school Jasmine Crockett voice, but worked her way into South Dallas Jasmine Crockett voice. It started out like she forgot mid-sentence. Oh, wait, I'm not talking to my cocktail crowd. Now I got to switch back in.
Yeah, I that is really a thing with her.
Yeah.
She just has two completely different personas. She just flips back and forth whenever she wants. I love the idea that she complains that she only had 20 minutes to put this information together. So she just picked, hey, I saw Jeffrey Epstein came. There's no pictures next to the donations. When, Rob, my thought is, if you only have 20 minutes and you can't lock down the information, you just don't say it on the floor of the House. It's not like you weren't required to blurt this nonsense out.
No, you just wanted to score points, and you wanted to do it with the delegate from the Virgin Islands who was coaching Jeffrey Epstein on how to talk to Congress sitting right next to you. That's how you want to do it, right? That's my favorite part of this whole thing.
Yeah.
Is literally the delegate who, by the way, why is a delegate from the Virgin Islands the ranking member of the Intelligence Committee when they're not an actual member of Congress?
Fair.
Which is a weird—
fair.
Mm-hmm. A weird thing.
Fair question. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating thing. Then that part of it is so bizarre as well. I mean, you realize the opinion you have of these Congress people is so much higher than it should be. I mean, even our low impression of them, like the woman who is— what's her name? Not Crockett, but the woman from the Virgin Islands. Her name.
I forget her name, but yeah.
It's escaping me at the moment. But she is on— I mean, you saw the video with the timing of the texts. Yeah. She's up there texting Jeffrey Epstein, a known pedophile this is after all the investigations have come out. We know everything that this guy did at this point, basically, or at least a good chunk of it. And she's texting and getting questions from him. That's really bad. But she's getting them with such little information that she thinks a first name, is either an acronym or a last name. She has no idea what she's even saying. This person is putting words in her mouth in the middle of a hearing, and she's just blurting it out. It's worse that it's a sex offender, but like at the end of the day, it's embarrassing that she would even ask a question like that.
If these people could actually do things with their lives, they wouldn't be in Congress. And that's kind of for both parties,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I remember, you remember Don Imus, God rest his soul.
Yes, of course I do.
Great radio in the morning. Like in the 90s, that's all I listened
Legend.
To.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have on a bunch of senators, but every once in a while, a congressman wanted to come on. And then he would yell at Chuck, and be like, oh, I don't want a congressman on. And then when they'd come on, he'd just berate him and say, do you have no dignity with your life? Why are you a member of Congress? He's like, it's the worst thing ever. He's like, could you not do something with your life? And I mean, that's kind of how you feel. And that's kind of how they act. It's insane that people think that politicians and people that work for the government are people to look up to. Because they're not.
It's absolutely unbelievable. So we have the situation where Crockett tries to trap Republicans by saying they got Jeffrey Epstein donations, makes a complete ass out of herself, thinking that the wrong person is Jeffrey Epstein, then says the excuse that she only had 20 minutes to look at it, so it's not her fault. And she wasn't trying to mislead people at all. That's why she said it was A, Jeffrey Epstein, not B, Jeffrey Epstein, which is unbelievable that she actually had knowledge about how bad her information was at the time. All that goes on. And then you see the Caitlin Collins response here, which I think is really fascinating. She, how many times do you see with Donald Trump, they're like, Donald Trump said this without evidence, right? That's not the treatment that Crockett gets.
No.
She gets the, some people are saying you should correct this treatment. Like, now I'm appreciative that she actually did ask a couple questions to her and followed up a little bit on it. But like, this is as dainty a hand you can have with a congresswoman who's on your air lying to everybody.
Yeah, some people say is the best form of journalism.
Yes.
Some people say that.
Mm-hmm. Some people do say that.
Some people do say that, yeah.
Caitlin Collins says it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's insane. It's everything is without evidence. You just attack Republicans. I mean, if they found out that the Kahim Jeffries thing, because the reason she did this is she was trying to protect Kahim Jeffries, whose campaign actually did invite the Jeffrey Epstein to go to a party in Manhattan or somewhere in New York for him, like the real one.
Mm-hmm.
And his, like, I had never heard his voice before. Oh my.
Wait, Hakeem Jeffries or Jeffrey Epstein?
Hakeem
oh,
Jeffries.
Gosh, yeah.
It is like, it's insane. It's like, yeah. It's insane. It's got like the lisp, but it's just weird.
That is quite the commentary on him because, yeah, what would your managing editor
yes.
of theblaze.com? You talk about Congress all the time. You're a total political nerd.
Yes.
You watch this stuff all day long, like I do, and you've never heard the voice of the Democratic leader of the House.
Right.
Like that is how much of a zilch this guy is.
Exactly.
Hakeem Jeffries is the worst.
He's Timu Cory Booker.
He is Timu Cory Booker. That's a good point.
Yeah.
And what's funny about this, and this, you know, end here, but like. The incentives of the Democratic Party right now are to be Jasmine Crockett, right? Like, you get rewarded for being a moron. You get booked not only on CNN, which she gets booked on all the time, MSNBC, all these things, but also, like, Colbert. Like, she's getting really good bookings. They are trying to make her a thing, and I am 100% here for it. Last word, Rob.
And, of course, she's going to win the U.S. Senate seat. In Texas, because this is the Democrats' year.
Yeah, it always
every
is.
Year is the every Democrats' year in Texas.
Now, I will say this, and someone reminded me of this. That's probably what everybody said about Trump on the right, on the left back in the day. Oh gosh, I hope they let him run. This will be easy. I am terrified that the voters will make dumb decisions, but I'm here for the entertainment. I'm conflicted about it. I'm complicated on this particular issue, but I do love her so. Rob Eno, managing editor, Blaze News. Thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me on.
By the way, we're renaming this podcast from Studios America to the Olivia Nuzzi update. That's all we're doing from now on. Actually, we only have a minor update for you today, although I did have some other questions. Olivia Nuzzi had a teenage pop star life before RFK Jr. and Mark Sanford and Keith Olbermann and all the rest. Recorded a song called Jailbait when she was 16 years old, which is, you know, I've got questions for the parents whether... I would say this is not a good idea, but she talks about if you hook up with her, it'll get you 20 years in prison. So building off of that, I have some questions for one Keith Olbermann. And I'm sure this isn't right, right? Like, this can't be the way that it happened. But let me just walk you through this timeline and tell me where I'm wrong. You know, maybe I'm wrong. So Olivia Nuzzi today is 32 years old, okay, in 2025. She was 31 in 2024, last year, when Keith Olbermann said of her that he has not spoken to her in 10 years. Just a, it's, okay, fine, great, perfect. Okay, so that brings us back to 2014, when she is 21. Now, it's been widely reported that they were dating when she was 21 and he was 55. And the overwhelming impression you get from that type of reporting is that they started dating when she was 21 and he was 55. But I don't think that's right. So, very clearly, if he hasn't spoken to her in 10 years, dates back to 2014 when she was 21 years old, that's not the beginning of the relationship. That's the end of the relationship. Now, how long was the relationship? Well, we know that also from Keith Olbermann. He said it just the other day, that they lived together for 4+ years. Now, you might be the type of old-timey person who thinks they may have gone on a few dates before they moved in together. You'd think they would, but maybe they didn't. Let's just say the entire relationship was 4+ years. That moves it back to 2010, when she's 17 years old. Now, I did look it up. The age of consent in the state of New York is 17. So he might be barely legal, as they say, but the plus sign in 4+ years is doing a lot of work, because if it, depending on how much plus there is there, he might be dealing with his own jailbait situation. Buying or selling a home should feel exciting, but instead it's stressful, right? And you're dealing with the biggest financial decision you'll ever make, and the whole thing hinges on whether the person guiding you actually knows what they're doing and whether you can trust them to put your interests first. RealEstateAgentsITrust.com does not hand you a random name from a directory. They vet agents the way that you'd expect someone to vet a surgeon, like looking for real experience, strong track records, and people who actually listen instead of just pushing you into the fastest deal. These are agents who understand pricing, they understand negotiation, they understand timing and inspections and all the rest. These are the details that are like key when you're talking about buying or selling a home. We talked about home ownership before. It's great for tons and tons and tons of people. If you're going to get into it, though, there are risks associated with it. So please find a good real estate agent. I beg of you. RealEstateAgentsITrust.com. RealEstateAgentsITrust.com. By the way, this is a free service to you. Why not take advantage of it? It's RealEstateAgentsITrust.com. Okay, so here's what happened. You want to get your kid a nice toy for Christmas. I would not recommend this one. Sales of an AI-enabled teddy bear are suspended after it gave advice on BDSM sex and where to find knives. Now, here's the adorable little bear. By the way, it says it's sold out. Actually, not true, because it's basically just, you know, suspended the sales. I will say they had, it's got AI in it. It's got like a ChatGPT in there. And they said in one interaction with the researchers, it suggested where to find knives in the home. In others, it was happy to discuss sexually explicit themes. We were surprised to see how fast the bear would get a single sexual topic we introduced into the conversation and run with it, simultaneously escalating in graphic detail while introducing new sexual concepts of its own. Goes on and on and on and on, and you just wouldn't think that you'd get this from a toy, especially an adorable bear like Kumma, spelled K-U-M-M-A, especially when the CEO of the company is Larry Wang.